WPFW, Washington.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone. Sunday County, some another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going across the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no. What'd I do?
Turn around, turn around. Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
The jury of your peers having found you guilty. 10 years.
What?
Come on, get in that cell.
I was in jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice, that's what you find, just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Good morning and welcome to Crossroads. We come to you every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock here on WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. WPFW is heard around the world, and we're grateful for the opportunity to share our information with other folks around the world. Go ahead, Nikisha. We're going to forsake the grapevine this morning. Nikisha got an announcement she want to make. Go ahead, Nikisha.
All right. So I will just call this part of the grapevine because it is information you can use, okay? Most folks don't realize that support for Crossroads comes in part from fashion designer Mertine Moore Brown, who as president of the company has created the Moore Wrap line of clothing and manages a training and sewing academy to instruct students in the style of this entire. More information is available at MELMPR.com. That's MELMPR.com. All right, Mertine. The more rap style of
thank
design.
You.
Back to you, Roach.
We have an interesting show this morning. We're waiting for at-large city councilman Robert White, who has agreed to join us. We've been having difficulty trying to get him on because they've been having council meetings on the day that we're on the air. So we weren't able to get him. Unfortunately, he'll be calling in shortly. What we wanted to talk about, is, first of all, was the D.C. youth curfew law as amended by the Juvenile Curfew Second Emergency Amendment Act. It mandates that all persons under the age of 18 cannot remain in any public place or on the premises of any establishment within the District of Columbia during curfew hours, unless they are involved in certain exempted activities. The law grants the chief of police the authority to establish extended juvenile curfew zones and allow the mayor of the District of Columbia to authorize an emergency juvenile curfew. The curfew hours are 11 p.m. to 6 a.m., 6 a.m., 7 days a week in juvenile curfew zones. Any person under the age of 18 gathering in a group of 9 or more youths in any public place or on the premises of any establishment within the perimeter of an extended juvenile curfew zone must leave the area unless engaged in certain exempted activities. The chief of police would designate the curfew hours within these zones and communicate them to the public, but they will not begin before 8 p.m. or end after 6 a.m. A list of declared juvenile curfew zones is available on the official website. The curfew law applies to all persons under the age of 18 who are in the District of Columbia during curfew hours, including the district residents and young people who reside elsewhere. That's the topic for the first half hour of the show. We're waiting on City Councilman at-large member Robert White to call in. Until then, Nikisha, we'll hold down the fort. What's your take on this juvenile curfew law, Nikisha? How do you feel about this, what the city council just passed last week in D.C.?
So, yes, Roach, I think it's just another example of the erosion of all of the positive policies that have been implemented over the past number of years in D.C. And it also really reminds me of our current federal legislation that's trying to deal with, you know, our right as residents of the District of Columbia and city council and the like to do our own criminal justice system policies. There is a bill called the Strong Sentences for Safer DC Streets Act of 2025. It's H.R. 5172 that would expand mandatory minimum sentences. It will worsen racial disparities. It will strain an already overburdened federal prison system. It will undermine our authority in the District of Columbia to shape policies that reflect the needs and values of our own residents. So what is happening with the juvenile situation is a microcosm of what the federal government is trying to do to Washington, D.C., you know, as a whole. I mean, there was a Supreme Court decision back in the day, 2012, called Miller versus Alabama, which talked about mandatory life without parole sentences for people under 18. And it said that it was unconstitutional. But this current federal legislation against the district, if it passes, would undermine the principle that minors must be afforded individualized consideration of their age and their development and their potential for rehabilitation before they impose any harsh mandatory minimums. So that what's happening locally and what's happening, the onslaught of federal against what's happening locally, it's all interconnected. So that's just my take on it.
Come on down. Yes, I'm just echoing of certain things. Thank you, Nikisha. We appreciate that. Boy, you said something else. Last week, we had on Liz Colmar from the Citizen Project, and we were talking about the bills that were pending in Congress, the Strong Sentences for Safer D.C. Streets Act, D.C. Incarceration Reduction Amendment Act. There are bills pending in Congress to restrict our rights here in the city. Good morning. We have joining us now City Councilman on the air with us, Robert White, at-large city councilman in Washington, D.C. And we were talking about the bill that was passed last week, Councilman White. And first of all, good morning to you, man. And how you doing?
I'm doing well. Good morning, brother. Good to be with you this morning.
I see we have the same barber, don't we?
That's right. The good Lord.
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well. I'm blessed, man. I am blessed and counting my blessings. And happy Veterans Day to any veterans out there.
Thank you. We got a lot of veterans, especially from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. So we got to designate what veterans we're talking about: military, corrections, law enforcement. we were talking about with Nikichi, our co-host, about this law that was passed last week by the D.C. City Council, the youth curfew law. And I understand you and along with three other city councilmen oppose this legislation. Why did you oppose it and what's your reasoning behind it?
Well, I'm glad we're having this conversation, Roach. So, yeah, I talked to a friend of mine this week who lives in Virginia. She lives in a predominantly white neighborhood. And she told me, you know, she got a notice from the community members that on Halloween, about 80 teens were out drinking, starting a bonfire on Halloween. The police came and just told everybody to go home, right? Amen. Now, she lives in a predominantly white community, but, you know, if that same thing happens in that community or another community with black teens, the response is going to be different, right? Yes. And we cannot afford to forget that that is the reality. We've seen already racial profiling against our teens here in the city. This is something that happened to a lot of us. So what I'm saying no to is two things. One, no to racial profiling against our black youth. But the second is, stop telling us for 6 months that all we can do for young people is set a curfew and engage them with law enforcement
there
and military.
You, yeah,
you know, you month one, okay, give yourself time to work out other ideas. But by month six, you got to have a plan. And a curfew is not a plan. It is just a hard mallet. And so, you know, no more this lack of plan, no more shortcuts, no more racial profiling. That's not going to fix the problem. It's going to make it worse. And I just can't be part of that.
We appreciate you taking a stand on it, because you're one of the few city council members who participated in a couple of events that we've had for organizing the return of citizens population in Washington. And we had one a couple of years ago, and you were the only council member who showed up. And you shared something personal that somebody in your family had an experience or an encounter with the criminal justice system. You want to share that with our listening audience?
Yeah, for those that don't know, my brother and I are incredibly close. We're only 15 months apart. We went through some difficult things as kids, and we remain close. But our paths, you know, diverged at a certain point. And my brother got into a bit of trouble as he was straightening his life out, and ended up in and out of D.C. jail and then in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. This is while I was finishing up law school and working for Congresswoman Norton. And when he came home to the halfway house, they released him to stay with me. But when he was incarcerated, just trying to study for the bar and keep him connected to his kids. So instead of studying on the weekend, I'm driving down to Petersburg with my niece and nephew. When he got back to the halfway house, the regulations and rules didn't make sense for reentering. They're telling him, yo, you got to get a job, but also you got to show up to do a urine analysis in the middle of the day. And, you know, you gotta pay, you know, stay at the halfway house, but we want you to go somewhere else and pay rent there too. You know, it just didn't make sense. So yeah. I decided if ever I was in a place to help incarcerated people or returning citizens, I was going to, you know, make that a priority.
We want to thank you for taking that stand, man, because that takes some nerve to take the stand that you did, because a lot of people like to hide their dark secrets. We all have secrets in our closet. I don't care who you are. And nobody's perfect or squeaky clean. And for you to come out public and say this, it tells a lot about your character, what kind of guy you was. And you've always accepted our calls. You've came whenever we suggested or requested you to be there. And I like your stand on this youth curfew act. Because as we said last week, we had a young lady from the Citizen Project. And there's four bills in Congress now that are designed to further restrict, harass, and deny us our rights and benefits. And one of the things that got us to kind of peeve, council member, is that why is it that it's all these bills are coming down to restrict, punish, criminalize, and penalize our youth? I understand this new bill, the impetus for this new bill was what happened last week, a couple weeks ago down at the wharf. 200-300 kids were out of control, just running and being routed. And I looked at it and said, even down there, it was 200-300 kids. We looked at the figures, there's 50,000 kids in D.C. public schools, 50,000, and 300 were rowdy and disrespectful, et cetera, down on the wharf. So out of 50,000, 300 act up, and you can punish 49,700 more kids who weren't there. And the kids, is what you said, I saw on the news, that they don't have nothing for them to do. There's no place for them to go. They want to go to the modern places, the hip places, where all the new foods and the new decorum and everybody hanging out. But our kids can't afford to go in these places, man. So if they don't have nowhere to go, what the hell do we expect them to do? Yeah. You know, kids want to be involved like we are. One of the things that we've been suggesting, Councilman, I haven't had a chance to share this with you, is that we need to elect a youth council. Every city councilman should have a youth assigned to them, and they'd be voted or elected by the youth in their particular ward or their school or local jurisdiction, so they can have a part. Because one of the things that ticks me off, and I'm really pissed about this, when Congress or legislators pass a law restricting women's right to have abortion under certain conditions or no conditions, these decisions are made by white men in an office all by themselves with women not involved. The same thing is true about people with handicapped disabilities. People make decisions for them, and the handicapped folks are not represented. So the kids are the only segment of our population who do not have a voice shaping or making an input in what's happening to our community. What's your take on this about having some youth elected as a youth council member that would work on all eight wards? It'd be a youth city council member and a mayor. Mm-hmm. So in the decisions that affect their health, welfare, and being, these youth would have input. What's your take on this, sir?
I think it's a great idea, but here's the key though, Roach. we actually have to listen to them. So, yeah, you know, so that's the key. So we that's where our challenge comes a lot of times. We don't want to listen. We don't bring them to the table. Then we bring them to the table and we don't listen to them. So we have a youth council and a youth mayor here in the district. But I think we have to utilize them the way that you're suggesting. Sorry, I got distracted. My oldest daughter walked into my office. I'm doing an interview, sweetheart.
Hello.
How old is she?
This is Madison. She is 9.
Hello, Madison.
Madison, our grandbaby's 11. We know how you feel.
Is Madison one that answered your voicemail?
Voicemail.
Yes, indeed. That's her voicemail. Yeah. Voicemail.
You sound so cute, young sister. Lady.
That's my
wonderful,
baby, man.
Priceless.
Love that girl. But we have to listen to our young people. You know, it wasn't that long ago that I was one of these young people feeling like, hey, the folks in charge clearly don't care. They're not listening to us. And I see myself being profiled everywhere I go. Roach, believe it or not, I used to have hair, right? I wore my hair like my friends. I wore cornrows and then I had long dreadlocks. You know, I wore puffy coats like the rest of my friends. And so I fit a profile, and I wasn't trying to fit a profile. I dressed like my peers. I hung out with my peers. But often, you know, I'd be targeted. We'd be targeted because of the way that we looked or because we were in a place that yeah. folks didn't want us. We made people feel uncomfortable. And I grew up going to the Go-Go's, and you know, we had a crime problem, and they said, oh, the problem is the Go-Go's. And we're like, that's not the problem. The problem yeah. is poverty and drugs right. and the lack of services for young people. You know, yeah. so stop in politics. Stop taking the shortcuts and saying, well, let's just send in police. Let's just set a curfew. At some point, you got to solve the damn problems. There's a reason these young people are not home at 11 o'clock at night. There's a reason that they're looking to drugs and alcohol, and we can sweep it under the rug and it won't go away, or we can engage the problem and really like lean into these young people. Yeah. So, you know, I'm about leaning in. I have a bill that I still need more support from the council for, to create a citywide mentorship program. We have about 40,000 people who work for DC government. What I'm saying is give them a couple hours every week where they still get paid for their job, but they are tutoring or mentoring a young person in D.C.
There you go.
That's going to make a difference in this.
Yes, I love
it. You know, I'm glad you said that. Yes. We will meet with a group called Optimistic Gentlemen and Ladies. These are gentlemen and ladies who did 40, 50, 60 years or more in prison. Okay. And they are working to give back. We have the resource. We have the horses, but we don't have the resources. You have a lot of these kids that are doing the shooting and the killing. Their uncles, fathers, and brothers are now just being released. We got somebody who can reach these kids. And you got men and women who are going mentor, like our next guest, Jimmy Gardner. We got men and women who've been in prison who are mentors. They've been mentored while they're inside. Now we got the guys in the street. They want to get involved. We've been working with talking to people at Kenilworth. We can reduce the crime. I don't care if Trump submitted $20 billion to Argentina, or it was Venezuela, rather, $300 billion to Ukraine, $500 million for a ballroom. These monies can be used not only for the SNAP program for food, but to hire and retain men and women who can stop it. We can make the streets safe. That's right. Know how to make it. They need programs. They need social services. As you said, a lot of these kids don't have a home. What's not being said is a lot of these kids are homeless. And if they do have a home, they can't go there because of the confusion and the tension and the crime is going on. So these kids are roaming the streets with nowhere to go. And they're asking us for help. They need our help. That thing about Marion Barr's Summer Youth Job Program, that was beautiful, but that's only for 90 days. Mm-hmm. Kids get a check for 90 days. When the 90 days is over, they don't have no more checks. They don't have no more money. They can't go nowhere. And with the prices going up, we need, with Kamal Ali and Vince Chilibo, we were with another group called Time to Get Involved. There's organizations, Bob, that's doing all kinds of stuff, but they don't have the resources to do. We got men who's willing to come to Southeast Washington. They don't have the funds to ride the bus to get over to work on the corner to escort kids back and forth to school. We got guys working in schools now, escorting kids back and forth, and they can't even get car fare to get over there to work with the kids. So as what you said on one of the newscasts, we need to invest more into the future of our kids. Because let me say this, and then I'll pass it. Kids are getting locked up, and they're saying these crimes as juveniles don't count. That's jiggy boogie. When you get locked up as a juvenile, you can be 30, 35 years old, and they go way back and pulled up. You got locked up at the wharf. And they say you're not supposed to use your juvenile records. But anything they can use to marginalize, or isolate, or penalize our kids, they're doing it. So we need resources. We need people like you to push the ball down the street to say, hey, here's what's going to happen. We can stop out. We can make the streets safe. We don't need a thousand on National Guard and spend $1 million a day. We can do it for a lot cheaper and safer.
Yeah.
And save our kids' lives and future. Because when they get one arrest, that one arrest may dog them for the rest of their entire life.
That's right.
So go ahead, Nikisha. I see like you want to jump in.
Oh, no, I just wanted to congratulate your council member for all the work that he's been doing on the council and also this new mentoring bill that, you know, he's spoke of. I mean, it just really needs to be recognized that our city council is better positioned to swiftly and collaboratively deal with our issues here in this city, our local public safety needs. And I'm sorry. I'm someone who works on the federal level also. You know, this federal interference in our local politics is just, unfounded. And we need a justice system, a juvenile justice system, and justice system in general that's shaped by the leaders that we elect and not by those that are imposed upon us by Congress. I just want to say kudos to everything that you're doing and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Hey, I have a question, council member. When these kids are arrested for violating the curfew, where are they taken? Are they in custody? Do they go to a detention facility? Are they placed in handcuffs? Or where do the kids who violate the curfew go?
Yeah, good question, Roach. So I don't think any kids have been arrested for violating the curfew, but that raises two important points. One is, The what you mentioned that happened down at the Navy Yard, all the examples of these youth issues happen before the curfew time. So passing a curfew law just allows you to sweep the issue under the rug, but again, doesn't address it. Like these things are happening at 6:30. The curfew is at 8 p.m. Yeah. But the second is folks will point to things like destruction of property and say, that's why you need a curfew. Well, destruction of property is already against the law. So you don't need a new curfew law, right? In order to address that issue. And so I just see us increasingly creating more barriers between us and young people, more hurdles, more interaction with police without solving a single problem. But I don't think any youth has been arrested yet for violating the curfew, but they have been harassed. And that is going to come back to haunt us because you don't engage the system that harasses you. You rebel against it and that becomes a problem.
You know, you said the thing about most of the kids are being arrested or harassed on this curfew, black and brown. This is racial profiling. And we know what it is. When you go down to the D.C. Superior Court, the juvenile division, go in the courtroom. 80 to 90% of the defendants are black and brown. There are hardly no white youth arrested for curfew. And he's talking about targeting these curfew. I haven't seen no sign of a curfew in Wisconsin Avenue, Connecticut Avenue, no curfew zones. These kids got places to go. My wife and I, we ride through the neighborhood and I see kids on the corner and it hurt, Rob. It hurts, man, because they're standing there. They can't afford to go to a country club. They don't have $100,000. They can't even afford to get a bus from Southeast to Northwest. It costs $8 to $10 a ride to get the buff or whatever. It costs money to move in this city. And when you don't have no money, no income coming in, no voice in what's being decided about you, you're left out there. It's like in the Civil War. I still wonder why all the surgeons in the Civil War were doctors who amputated your arm and the legs. They didn't have no other treatment. So
that's right.
Amputation was the main cause. Incarceration now seems to be the only thing that they're looking at to control our kids.
That's right.
You said, and I forgot that we have a youth mayor and youth council. They need some juice. They need some power. They need some authority. They need something, some input that would determine how they will spend the rest of their life and won't have a stigma on their record that will prevent them from trying to maintain a regular life.
Right.
These are the kind of things that we're talking about.
So I would like to know, why don't we have 24/7 facilities for our young people to go to? That's what we need, 24/7, where real mentors are, not pedophiles.
That's
real
right.
Mentors who care and love our children, a library, a basketball court, a place just to chill out, look at movies. Why don't we have facilities like that where children feel safe and welcome to come to?
Great question. Because it's not a priority. Look at all the things we do have, all the things we throw money at, and we say, well, we're doing this because it's going to bring in more money and that's going to help the city. But then we invest that money in the same kinds of things. And so folks, especially young people, get left out. You can look around and tell whether a space is built for you or with you in mind at all. But this is something that we need to move on. And interesting you say that. There's a brother who I find very inspiring. He was just released from incarceration maybe 6-7 months ago. He's built up a humongous social media following. He's so positive. His Instagram handle is Mr. Watch Me Work. And he and I sat down, and he and his comrades, all of them formerly incarcerated, but just really righteous brothers, focus on physical health, mental health, internal health, and just really focused, said that what they want to create is this 24/7 facility for young people.
There you go.
That have folks that understand them, that welcome them, things that these young people want to do. And I thought it was such a phenomenal idea. So I'm trying to work with them to make their dream come alive.
I'd like to connect us to them, because we'd like to talk to somebody like that.
You will love these brothers. I will connect you.
Often say that those closest to the problem are the ones closest to the solution. So what you're saying, council member, sounds very close to that whole model dealing with the brothers. In fact, some of the most phenomenal programs out there for formerly incarcerated people come from those who were formerly incarcerated themselves. And Roach Brown, you're a perfect epitome, of that yourself. So,
Hey. I know you can't stay with us much longer, Councilman, but as my wife suggested, we've been meeting with Kamal Ali, Kenny Barnes, Tyrone Parker, folks all over the city, man, to deal with this. Crews, and we got the men, like I said, we got the horses, but we don't have the resources. We got men who did 50, 60 years in prison. And would you believe, you look at them, you can't tell they did that much time. And the first thing they say, man, I'm rolling up my sleeves. Let's get our youngsters. Let's reach them. But they don't even have car fare, bus fare. And when they get over there, they ain't got nothing to eat. They don't have lunch.
Right.
We can't get the resources to make sure our horses can go to work. We can save, we can make the streets safe. When they talk about sending the National Guard in Washington, man, that's a jiggy boogie. Ain't nothing. I talk to people in Southeast and the National Guard, the two highest crime wards in the city is 7 and 8. The National Guard is not in Ward 7 and Ward 8. People in Ward 8 say they've never seen the National Guard unless they go down to Union Station by the White House.
Yeah.
And they can see in position where the crime rate is virtually non-existent or low at them places. As my wife said, we need a 24/7 place in every ward. When I see these kids standing on the corner, they're right in front of a church. It's closed.
Yeah.
The school is around the corner. These buildings are sitting there after 5 o'clock. Nobody's in them. They're vacant and closed. We got people who can staff and man this and make sure our kids get treatment that they need, man. So whatever you can do, council member, whatever you can suggest that we can do to help make this a reality, because we know action is better than inaction.
That's right.
And if we get our kids, man, because I don't want to see nobody, like you said, you was locked as a youngster. We all went through that as a young man, going through all these stages. You're exerting your manhood. You're smelling yourself. You think you're bad. You can
do
this. You know, and this ain't going to happen to me. And you get caught up in it. And you don't realize 20 years later, that arrest will come back and smack you in the face, even though it's a juvenile. So we need your help, council member, and whoever else on the council that we can approach to see what we could do to make sure that our kids get a fair shot. I know you got to go, so I want to give you the opportunity with some closing remarks, Councilmember Robert White, before you leave.
Absolutely. Well, Roach, I appreciate you having me and the work you're doing. Let's keep working. We got to get more support on the council for these programs, because we can't put in place a curfew, but not put in place a mentorship program. That's just not right. You know, we can't say we got money for a stadium, but not money for a 24/7 youth facility. If we are saying that we prioritize and care about our young people. So we've got to stay focused. And the last thing I'll say, because, you know, I'll be in trouble if I don't say it, just given everything that's happened in our city, you know, National Guard, that's $1 million a week that we could be spending to solve homelessness, solve crime. But the folks are not interested in solving the problem, but they're interested in taking over our city. And so, contrary to my plan, I plan to run for mayor again, but I realize we're not likely to have a mayor or council in a few years if we don't start winning some of the fights on Capitol Hill in the White House. So I'm now running to replace my former boss, who I think is not going to run for Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton. But I'm running for our congressional seat because we need somebody who understands our city, who's going to fight for our city and make sure we don't keep participating in our own annihilation, because that's what this White House is focused on. And more incarceration ain't going to help us. We've really got to help people, and we got the resources to do it. So I appreciate you having me and appreciate the work you're doing. You continue to be on the grind, Roach.
Thank you, man. And and don't forget, give me the name of your barber, because my hair's starting to grow again. And I ain't got but a few hairs up. I want to get them cut.
You got it.
We want to thank City Councilman Robert White, at-large member of the D.C. City Council, one of the supporters who's really attacking the issues of our youth, man, and making sure that we stop all this jiggy-boogie, this racial profiling. My hat's off to you. I hope you're successful, whatever you do. And I'd like to invite you back, City Councilman Robert White, for Crossroads. And thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Roach, before Martine does station ID, can I just give a quick shout out to somebody? I just wanted to say happy birthday to Harlow Brian Sales, who's been incarcerated for over 40 years, and Jessup in Maryland. Today is his birthday. He went in as a juvenile, over 40 years ago. So I just wanted to give him a shout out for his birthday today.
Thank you, Harlow Brian Sales.
Jessup.
Yes, we love you. Yes. This is WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. You can still donate always to Crossroads, $WPFW FM. We love you. Stay tuned for our next guest, Jimmy Gardner.
And I just want to say that our next guest is a personal friend of ours. It's like Councilmember Robert White. And I met this gentleman about 6-7 years ago. His name is Jimmy Gardner. He was a convicted felon from 1990 until his convictions were overturned and all charges dropped in 2016, establishing his innocence. This guy has an unusual story. Twice convicted and twice exonerated. I mean, he did 20-some years the first time and was exonerated. That there was some shady evidence and the government didn't do what they're supposed to do. And the brother served 27 years in prison. He got released. And would you believe he got arrested for the same charge, sexual abuse charge, years later. And he got locked up again. And we read the article. And I got right on the phone and I called him. I said, Jimmy, what's happening, man? Because I was hurt when I read that you got arrested again for this sex case down in Florida. And it hurt me. And Jimmy said, man, I didn't do this. And he got me wrong. And when you said that, I believed you, man, because I called you. I don't care what happened. If you want a friend of mine and they lock you up, I'm going to call you to see what can we do, or what's the deal on, or what's the real deal on this case. And Jimmy told me then, said, man, I didn't do this. And here's the only man in America who's been arrested twice, convicted once, charged second, and he's been exonerated for both charges. And a young lady who charged you on this second charge for sexual harassment or sexual abuse admitted that she lied and she didn't tell the truth. How did this, man, I know you lost a lot of support, Jimmy Gardner, from your friends and family when they read, because when I first heard the story, I said, man, he must have done it the first time. They exonerated him on the first case. He used to play for the Chicago Cubs summer league or minor league team, a professional baseball player. Had a beautiful future ahead of him. And all this was pulled out from under you. And this guy is still fighting. Good morning, Jimmy Gardner.
Good morning, Roach. How are you, my brother?
How you doing, man? I take my hat off to you. You're a strong soldier, man. I mean, what you've been going through, and I don't know how you do it, man. Thank you for being here, Green Insurance, and your agent, that Ramon Bain. Boy, she's something else. She said, you better get Jimmy on that show. I said, you had him on there before. She said, well, get him back. So you're back, Jimmy.
Yes. It's my pleasure to be back also, Roach. And I thank you and Ms. Martin for having me on Crossroads again. And like you stated, you know, it's been a long time. We met maybe 6-7 years ago, and it's been nothing but a great opportunity to remain friends and just have a great relationship with you and Ms. Martin. I'm thankful.
How did you feel, Jimmy, when you got arrested again and you were married to Stacey Abrams' sister? She ran for governor down in Georgia, in Atlanta. And it was a high profile situation. And I know people turned their back on you. They didn't want to see you. They figured you were guilty of the first offense because you got a second offense of the same similar kind of charge. But you hung strong, man. You still strong. You held your head up. You didn't bend over. How did you tell us what you were experiencing when you went through this, man?
Well, first and foremost, I always give praise to God. You know, I walk in faith, and I just try to understand and represent every day that, you know, I got a mission here and I got purpose to do a job that requires a lot. And so I'm just thankful to have God with me at all times. So I remain prayed up. And you asked the question about how I felt. You know, I tell you, it was very traumatic. It was very, very traumatic. You know, words can't completely express it, because being handcuffed again and being in the position to be charged for a crime for the second time that I did not do. And I was charged with sex trafficking, which, you know, was just ridiculous. But I had to go through the process. So I went inside of the jail and I got booked and I got arrested and had to go through the entire process, going to court, you know, having charges read, being incarcerated for days, just hearing doors slam, you know, all of it, going through booking. All of this was just very, very, very traumatic. And I just continue to get therapy. And I'll see my therapist and try to do my best to continue to move forward, because I got work to do.
Yeah.
And that work requires me to be prepared. And I got to fight this fight against injustice and inequality. And, you know, our people are in dire straits, and we just got to have individuals that are fighting on their behalf. So that's what I do.
You know, Jimmy is a motivational speaker. And he goes all around the country speaking. And one of the things that popped up in my mind is that, how was it between you and your wife when the charges came down? You were married. And how did your wife accept this? Because this is a similar charge to your first charges you were exonerated from. What was the thing? What was the conversation like between you and your wife? Did she believe you? Did she trust you? People turned their back on you. You felt embarrassed, humiliated. Man, you went through all of the negatives all over again, and you found out that the criminal justice system worked right the first time to exonerate you. Now you go back in the same situation, and you're facing the criminal justice system again, and you know how crazy, rotten, and messed up the system is. Did you think you had a chance of coming out of this clean like this?
So let me address the first statement. My wife is the Honorable Leslie Abrams Gardner, and she is United States District Court judge down in the Middle District of Georgia. And she's the Chief Justice at this time. And my wife has been nothing short of just amazing and remarkable. She has stood by my side from day one. When I actually, before I even was arrested, you know, I called my wife and explained to her that I was actually in a situation. And she was immediately supportive right there. She flew down to Florida, and she was right there by my side, you know, when I got arrested. And I tell you, the one thing that my wife continued to tell me, she stayed on the phone with me throughout the arrest. She said, baby, whatever you do, do not say one word. Don't talk. Don't say one word. She said, you're going to jail. you know, but don't say one word. And I tell you, me being a formerly incarcerated person of almost 30 years, I wanted to just speak out. I wanted to say, hey, I'm not guilty of this. I wanted to shout my innocence and try to explain the situation. But my wife was like, do not say one word. And that is so important because individuals think that they have to prove themselves innocent at that time. And all you're actually doing is putting more evidence or information on yourself that's going to be twisted by the judicial process, the officers, who's ever involved. Your words will be held against you and twisted. So you don't say anything. And I just strongly just recommend don't talk. Shut it down. Shut it up. You know, be careful with everything you do. And I was just so fortunate to have her on my team. And she's just so remarkable. And of course, you know, this was just very damning and damaging to my family, my wife, and especially her job and position. So you can only imagine all of the insults and all of the harm that was done to her. And, you know, it was just so degrading, and she just endured it all. And you know, we've been through counseling, and we're still in counseling behind this. You know, this is a very, very horrible thing. You know, it can destroy your family. And I'm so thankful to God that my wife stood by my side and she remains by my side. But it's a work. You know, I tell people it's a work, you know, because what God has for you, no man can destroy. Yes. And my wife and I, we love each other, and we've made it through this ordeal, and we continue to move forward. But we are constantly, and we stay in therapy for the betterment of our marriage. But we're doing great. Thank you.
Beautiful. Go ahead, Nikichi.
Okay, so I just want to say, I must be very honest. When I first looked at who Jimmy Gardner was, I was just skimming. And I originally thought that you were arrested for the same the same actual charge. I'm thinking double jeopardy. How could they, you know? But then when it was something that was similar but a different situation, but now hearing who you're married to, who her sister is, let me tell you the question that's popping up in my mind. Was there any other type of interference or, I don't know quite how to say what I'm saying. Were you targeted? Okay. Was this a political, some type of political targeting to bring you down, to bring your wife down, to bring your wife's sister down? I came up during the phase of the COINTELPRO, the FBI secret illegal program to disrupt and destroy Black people and Black movements. And there were tactics that were used to, you know, demonize people's characters, and false charges were placed upon them. Did that ever cross your mind? Were there any inkling that there was some type of nefarious interference going on with you that was targeting you and your family?
To answer your question as briefly as possible, undoubtedly it was political also. But, you know, this situation doesn't even get to be a situation if I don't entertain a conversation with this person. You know, it was undoubtedly, you know, stated, and, you know, the records will reflect this individual has came and said that she was lying about the incident, this and that. And of course, you know, I won't go deeply into it because I don't want to rehash things or I'm not attacking this person. You know, there could be any types of issues, mental or whatever, that may be, you know, happen for this person to bring about this situation. All I do is say, hey, I'm thankful that I was able to go through this process and get my justice and get relief in this situation without having to be incarcerated and placed into, you know, just difficult situations again, taking my life from me. But, I say with great respect that the truth came to the top. The truth rose to the top, and I'm in a position to be exonerated from the charges of sex trafficking in federal court. And now I move back into a position of trying to regain my life and get back on track doing the things that I do. And that's fighting against injustice and inequality and speaking for wrongfully convicted people and rightfully convicted people that have been through just traumatic situations and had injustice done to them and inside the judicial process. But I'm just blessed to be here. And I always encourage people to just go in and check out the record. You know, it's public notice, it's public record. You know, the entire incident, all of the accounts is public record. And I'm just thankful that I was able to be exonerated again. And I tell you all, you know, faith is and prayer is so important. I prayed from day one, God, just please deliver this person and allow this person to tell the truth and be honest about what the accounts that occurred. And I prayed for that. I prayed, God, please bring her into your fold. And I tell you, 17 months after the incident, it occurred. And this young lady went to the prosecutor and stated that she had lied about certain accounts and this and that, and just, you know, misled the situation. And the prosecutors were left with the decision to dismiss all charges with prejudice. But I encountered a very, very difficult process. And unlike many people in our country or in the world, everybody doesn't have six, seven figures lying around where they can, you know, put up for their legal defense and be able to be in a position to pay off experts, attorneys, this and that. And when you're in a federal situation and state situation and you have charges off the top, this federal attorney is going to charge you between $300,000 to $500,000. That's $300,000 to $500,000. That's coming off the top. And most people don't have this type of monies. That's why I started the Jimmy C. Gardner Foundation for Social Justice and Civil Rights. I want to be able to provide legal representation and provide opportunities for individuals to have support from a mental perspective, you know, dealing with emotional intelligence, dealing with having an opportunity to fight for their lives and liberty and get great representation. So I've had my organization has just been put into registration in the state of Georgia, and we're moving forward. We have it's been incorporated, and we have the articles, you know, and the certification. And I'm not just talking this talk. I want to walk the walk. So I want to provide opportunities because many of our young men and women are going through this judicial process, and they don't stand a chance without great representation and support. So that's what this foundation is about, the Jimmy C. Gardner Foundation for Social Justice and Civil Rights.
It was meant for you to do that. I mean, like you say, we hate the experiences we have to go through, but these experiences bring out what's in your heart, what God wants to use and needs to use, because we grew up in a country that hasn't changed. It's always been inequality. It's pathetic that it's even on a higher burn now. And we got to fight. We have nothing to fear.
You know, one of the things that pop into mind, Jimmy, how did this affect your wife? You were married to Stacey Abrams' sister. She's a federal judge. Mm-hmm. And I know she caught holy hell from the other judges, the people in the judiciary and law enforcement, that here's a federal judge marrying a returning citizen. And he get locked up for the same thing. And you know, by being doing 27 years the first time, there's a lot of guys inside who don't belong in there and never get the opportunity that you got to get their record straight or get exonerated. What impact has this had on your wife, man, in her career?
You know, it was a very difficult because, like you said, you know, she's around former judges and prosecutors and individuals, you know, that love her. Leslie is loved throughout the judicial process. She's loved by her peers. And of course, you know, there were individuals, you know, within her circle that told her probably from the beginning, don't get with this guy. He's been in prison, this and that. But Leslie and I love each other. We move forward. And she gave her all to our marriage and our relationship, as well as I. And this incident undoubtedly caused such harm, but it wasn't irreparable, you know, because we have moved forward. We don't allow anything to come in and tear us down. But this was a very difficult time for Leslie, and it still is, you know. And you had individuals that were, you know, making certain comments behind her back, you know, in her face, yeah. You know, having, you know, presented to her options of staying on as a judge or leaving her bit. Of course, she definitely wouldn't do. She wouldn't even entertain anything like that. As a federal judge, that's a lifetime appointment, you know, unless the federal judge themselves are convicted of a crime. So it was just so disrespectful and just horrible for individuals to even come about with such a question or suggestion. But my wife and I, you know, we remain strong and God has us. And I tell you, throughout the ordeal, Leslie said, she said, God got us. You know, she said, I'm with you. God got us. And we're going to get through this. And I believe, you believe, we're okay. And all she would say is, God got us.
Yeah.
And that was so powerful.
Yes.
Just so powerful. So blessed, you know.
In all situations, in all traumatic situations or disappointments, no matter how dark it gets, the sun always shines.
Yes, sir.
There's always a blessing coming out of that. What have you found out? What blessings have you gotten out of this last experience of being accused, falsely accused of a crime that you didn't commit? And you did 27 years on the first one, and you get locked up again. I know you must have said, what the hell is, what's going on here? Because you know you didn't have a chance, snowball chance.
Yes,
what do
sir.
You say to that?
So first off, you know, like I said, I always go back to God and my faith. And I let individuals know that if you truly believe, you stay the course, there's never a doubt. There's never a question if God is going to come through for you, if you're going to be able to overcome the situation. But if you're doubting, if you have any doubt, you're not providing a place where you're going to be presented with the outcome being in your favor. You have to have total faith. You have to believe. You have to have unwavering faith. And, you know, that's what I have. I've had that, you know, basically throughout my life. But I gained so much perspective from this encounter. And the most important position I've gained was my family and my wife. I have to understand that I am in a position where any little thing or whatever may come about that I do or encounter, it harms them just horribly. So I will never have my individual family or my loved ones be in a position of such. And I also became so much more aware of my wife's love for me. And, you know, I'm a very, very just straightforward person. And, you know, I don't overcome this situation without my wife and without my higher power, God. And I just, you know, I want individuals to know that everything we grow through, there's an opportunity. Everything we go through, there's an opportunity to grow through it.
There you go.
And if you take the optimistic position and perspective on moving forward in a positive way and receiving the blessings from the situation, you can't lose. It's a win-win situation. And so I'm more focused on what I'm here to do. I'm more focused with my job, J.C. Gardner Speaks, my LLC, my speaking opportunities to share my testimony. I'm more focused on Gardner House. I'm more focused on dealing with individuals coming out of prison, being able to give them mentorship or being able to provide them with just opportunities for higher learning and getting themselves prepared for society, sharing my testimonies. And like I said before, my foundation. This new foundation, you know, I've been led in this direction to do the Jimmy C. Gardner Foundation for Social Justice and Civil Rights. And I just think it's going to be one of the, you know, most humbling and just phenomenal opportunities to give back that I've ever encountered. And I just encourage all to be out there. We're 501c3. We're nonprofit. This foundation has been already registered and approved, and individuals wanting to donate and be a part of this in their way, share their monies, time, efforts. We are all receiving. And it is just wonderful. We're starting here. We're going to be down here in Georgia, in Atlanta, Georgia. And I just encourage all to stay tuned and understand that this is what we need in our society. We need individuals that have went through the fire. And I've went through that fire twice exonerated. And I know my mission, and it's not about me. It's about our people, and to be able to be the light for our people and the example for our people. So with this duty, I understand this is a duty, and I'm keeping myself on the right track, moving forward and doing the work of the Lord and doing the work of the people.
You know, you're really blessed, Jimmy, because to be exonerated once, then to turn around and be arrested and be exonerated twice. That is unbelievable, man, and it's unusual. And yes, the sir. Lord made this happen for a reason. You go through these, a lot of times people get mad about a storm because it's destructive. The storm just come through to clear up the air, to move out things that you don't need. And when you found after the storm, the sun always shine. And yes, the sir. Sun and the sun is shining. And you've been able to take lemon and make lemonade, brother. I mean, yes, and you just took one lemon and made a pineapple. You know what
How
I mean?
About that?
So yes, I want sir. To take my hat off to you. And for folks who are listening, believe that you can do anything you set your mind to. If you got the Lord in your corner, you're believing that no matter what happens, it's happening for a reason.
That's right.
Every situation, there's always a blessing in every bad situation. What blessings? You already told us that a couple of times. We got a couple of minutes. Can you give us a couple of minutes before we get off the air, Jimmy, about what you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I tell you, you know, I've been blessed in so many ways, you know, and I got great people around me, like Mrs. Ramon Bain. Miss Ramon Bain out of Washington, D.C., you know, my publicist, she's just phenomenal. And she's been with me throughout this ordeal and trying to get back on track, you know, and having Roz, you know, Rosalind Ray with me and Zenobia Waters, you know, these individuals are a part of my team, and always having Amanda Simmons with me. You know, she's been on my team since day one, and my family, you know, having just strong women and powerful women and keeping me on track and making sure that I'm moving in the right direction, namely with my wife, the Honorable Judge Leslie Abrams Gardner. You know, that's the number one, and my mother, Miss Gladys Gardner. Okay. You know, I've had
she's still living. Women.
You want to give our listeners how to contact you? If somebody want to contact you, give them your contact information, please.
So I'm Jimmy C at JC Gardner Speaks. You can contact me at that email, or either info at JC Gardner Speaks. And my current, you know, phone number, my business phone number has not been started again, but my phone number is 703-350-8026.
You want to call me? Say it one more time.
Say it again.
703-350-8026. And I'm getting back on track. I look forward to speaking. I look forward to sharing my testimony. There's so much I want to tell the world and provide. And I want to do. I want to be able to put it in motion, you know, and any individuals out there that want to be a part of this justice fight and inequality fight, you know, please join in. You have the opportunity.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank
you. Wonderful.
You've been listening to Jimmy Gardner, twice convicted, twice exonerated. He's a powerful motivational speaker. He's a good friend of ours, man. And I take my hat off to you, because I thought you were dead when I read that case. Jimmy's gone, because you can't beat these people, man. But somehow you were able to come out this, man, and I take my hat off to you. Congratulations to you, your wife, and your family.
Thank you. Keep on
keeping on. And call us, man, if we can be of assistance. And I'm going to call Ramon Bain and tell her to give me a hat or a cone.
A. Scott Boland was right there with me also. I got to tell people in D.C., my attorney, A. Scott Boland, my friend,
okay.
Right there in D.C.
Stay tuned for a minute.
There'll be a grand celebration of Veterans Day, Tuesday, November 11th, at the African American Civil War Memorial, Vermont Avenue and 10th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. We'll be reading the names aloud of the 209,145 black soldiers and their white officers that are written on the memorial walls. People are coming from all around the country to participate. The live reading will also be streamed nationwide via YouTube. If interested in joining us in person, you'll receive a list of names upon arrival and participants of all ages, including adults and children, are welcome. For more details, go to afroamcivilwar.org.
Peace, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening